I think of a retreat as being a journey, and there's many ways in which it can be a journey. One is that we go from A to B, and there's an arc in which we go from the beginning to the end, and it's an arc that sometimes is invisible on the first day, where it just sometimes just seems like maybe it was a mistake to come here, or it just seems so difficult, or the mind seems so out of control, or but it's definitely an arc. And I think the arc is quite individual. There are patterns which different people take, but I prefer to see it as being very individual, depending on, you know, where we're at, what's happening with us in our life, and what needs to happen. And I have a stronger and stronger belief over time that on retreat there are no mistakes, that at least in terms of practice and developing ourselves this arc, that everything, when we're practicing mindfulness and this kind of deep reflection that we do and introspection and trying to figure out how to meet every situation with some degree of freedom and compassion, that no matter what happens, it becomes just wonderful fuel, wonderful reason to keep exploring this and discovering how to do this. And that way it's not a mistake. It's just one more thing to have to address. In fact, sometimes when it seems like it is a mistake, because it's been activated us in a big way, the degree to which we're activated represents the degree to which it's actually quite important for our psyche, our heart. Something important, really important, has been touched. So there's an arc from A to B. And then, as sometimes it's said, that the arc is from A to A, really. That we are not really going anywhere. We're just finding a way to arrive more fully and deeply into this moment that we're in, into our lives as it actually is. And so we're kind of following a variety of paths as we go through the retreat, so we can better and better arrive and be fully here for our experience as it is. And one of the ways that the tradition talks about fully arriving and being here in our experience in a way that's kind of quite full and complete is to be present without any clinging. Sometimes it's talked in grand terms as Nibbana without clinging, or through non-clinging. Release through non-clinging. And I'm sure there's many ways of talking about this. So in the theme for this retreat, seven stages of purification, there's a story from the suttas where two monks are talking, and one of them is Sariputta, and he's heard that this other monk is quite mature in his practice, and I suppose he wants to test him a little bit. So he asks him, Sariputta asks this other monk, is it for the purpose of purification of virtue that you're practicing? Is it so you can become morally pure? And the other monk says, no, that's not the purpose. Well, is it for the purpose of the purification of the mind? And the monk says, no. Well then, is it for the purification of you? No. Is it for the purification of doubt? No. Well then, is it for the purification of the knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path? No. Well then, is it for the purification and vision? Is it purification of knowledge and vision? For having knowledge and vision of what is the practice? No. Well then, is it purification through knowledge and vision without anything extra there? And the guy says again, no, not even that. So then Sariputta says, well, what is your purpose for doing this practice? And the monk says, the purpose is to have release, freedom, nibbana, without clinging. That's the purpose. And then there's some more exchange, and then this monk explains that it's kind of like how if the king of the country wants to travel in a long distance quickly, they set up these relay stations along the way. And he gets on one horse and gallops off until the horse is exhausted. But just then they get to the first station and they change horses. And then the next horse takes you further, and the next horse takes you further, and so forth. And it's in the same way that all these stages of purification are part of the relay stations along the way. It isn't that they're not needed. It isn't that the monk doesn't practice these things, but that's not the purpose for practicing them. The purpose is freedom. And one of the things that I think is quite nice about this story, the idea of it, is that sometimes religious people get hung up around the whole point of the religious life is to be virtuous, to certain follow certain rules and ethics. In this story, it's important to be virtuous, to have virtue, but it's not the point. We don't want to get hung up around it. Some people, it's for some kind of purification of mind, concentration states. They're important, but that's not the point. We don't hold it lightly. Don't get hung up. Don't get sidetracked by giving too much ultimate importance in these things. Some people, it's their view and their understanding, various kinds of wisdom that can come along in practice. They have a role, but that's not the point. There are stations along the way. There are supports for going on. So even hold your understanding lightly. There's no need to get into big debates about what is the true Dharma or the real teaching. The purpose of the teaching, the purpose of insight, the purpose of wisdom is not to be someone who understands, but to be someone whose understanding leads to freedom, leads to a life that's, you know, filled with compassion and kindness and characterized by freedom. So these seven stages of purification are important, and there are stations along the way, horses along the way that we get on, but they shouldn't be taken as being ultimate or get too caught up in them. So the first one is called purification through virtue. And this idea of purification means that something is shedding, something is letting go, something is being purified from us. And when we practice virtue, for example, the precepts, we're kind of, it's a training not to be ethical for ethical sake, but to help free us of certain kinds of attachments that we get caught up in. Generally the case that people who break the precepts are not living, are really attached to something. They're clinging to something. Often with the precepts there's a degree of selfishness involved, or self-centeredness involved. Often with the precepts there's maybe strong desire that are operating. Sometimes there's strong fear that's caught people. And so the practice of the precepts is not just a practice of living a certain way, but it's rather a practice of heightened sensitivity to what are the inner forces within us that incline us or prompt us to be unethical. And then we want to purify that or empty that or resolve those, settle them out, work through them in some way. And I think this is a tremendously valuable thing for our society and our world, for people to live ethically. The basic principle of Buddhist ethics is not to cause harm. And the ethical understanding of Buddhism follows in the wake of this principle, don't cause harm. So, you know, I think it's dangerous to hold on to a precept, a rule, ethical rule, as if it's ultimate, and we have to hold on to it no matter what, because we're supposed to be pure, this is the right thing to do. It can lead to harm in the society and the world. It certainly can lead in harm where there are places where there's different ideas of what causes harm, what doesn't cause harm. There's different, you know, a certain degree of these things are relative depending on cultures and society and different places and different backgrounds. So the evaluation of ethics is the precepts that help us to look more deeply at where do we cause harm? Where is harm being caused? Is there harm being caused? What's the motivation? Are we causing harm in the world around us? Are we causing harm to ourselves? And from there we find our way, as opposed to holding on tightly to the rule itself. And one of the ancient slogans about Buddhism is definition of the Dharma. The word Dharma its character, as the saying is, the Dharma is characterized by ahimsa. And some of you might know that ahimsa is the Sanskrit word for, not usually translated into English as non-violence. It can also be translated as non-harming. And in this context, I like non-harming. The Dharma, you know it's a Dharma if it's characterized by non-harming, that it doesn't involve any harm. And so the precepts, the ethics, is a very important part of it. And it's very important for for setting the foundation for deeper wisdom. And wisdom is a foundation for greater virtue. And the Buddha talked about this wonderful kind of analogy or metaphor of it's like the right hand washes the left hand, the left hand washes the right hand, if you have two hands to wash. So in the same way, virtue washes wisdom and wisdom washes virtue. It's like two hands. They go close hand to hand together. And sometimes it's said in our tradition that there's these three trainings of virtue, meditation, and wisdom. That there's a kind of you can kind of perfect the training in meditation or concentration. You can kind of, it's possible to work and attain all the different states and capacities, skills. There are some people who are quite adept at these areas. And it's possible to attain the insight or the wisdom that the Buddha is pointing towards. And there's a kind of a finite quality to it. There's a certain, because it's supposed to be, it's functional wisdom. It leads to certain results. And when those results are attained, then that wisdom is complete in a sense. However, it's never possible to be complete with virtue, with morality, because there's always different circumstances in life, different situations. Things are changing. It's the world is the complex ecology of human lives and the lives in our world, environment, and how harm is caused and not is caused. So the idea of training in virtue is a lifetime of exploration, understanding, and finding our way. And I find it kind of nice that the first training is the one we never complete. It kind of keeps us a little bit humble, or keeps us as a beginner, or keeps us always kind of, you know, understanding that the practice, the mindfulness, is always being applied. We don't just finally just kind of rest and coast in enlightened oblivion, but we continue, you know, to pay attention and to reflect, understand what's going on in our world, so we can live in a wise way, live in a way that doesn't cause harm. And as it's often said, living an ethical life is a foundation for meditation and for wisdom, because it creates a stable mind, a still mind. A mind's not agitated or filled with agitation or remorse. So it's a conditions for it to be able to kind of get still and quiet and focused. And not a few people I know have tried to still and quiet their mind, and in order to do that, after a while they realized they had to kind of look at their behavior, look at their actions, look at their how they've caused harm in the world, and figure out how to come to terms with that in some wise way before they can really continue deeply in the practice. It's a very important step. But something to consider on a meditation retreat like this one, where, as I said last night, chances are that we're all going to live with fairly high ethical standards during this week, that the place of real exploration, the real kind of area where it's really important to explore this ethical side, is how you relate to yourself. How you kind of, what's going on in your own mind and your heart? What are the reactions and responses that you have that maybe are invisible, maybe you're not really acting on them? When your mind gets distracted, do you get angry at yourself? When you have a memory that maybe is painful, do you feel shame? When, do you feel guilty? If you come into the meditation hall late, are you then racked with guilt for the next hour? What are the forces of harm-making that can arise in the mind itself, that we can, that here in this kind of environment we can really feel and know and recognize it's happening? And so to be virtuous, the purification by virtue on retreat, has a lot to do with finding a way of being with your experience so that we're not in conflict with anything. As I said this morning, how can we hold what's happening with some generosity of spirit? How can we hold what's happening, whatever goes on, with compassion or care? Or how can we hold it with a kind of wisdom that allows it just to be there without then these second arrows that we add on top of it? We have all kinds of responses, reactions that arise in the mind, the heart. And to some degree, you know, we're not necessarily responsible for what first arises, but we are responsible to how we then add second or third or fourth arrows to it. And can we begin to bring a response of kindness to the experience, or a response of generosity to ourselves? Can we meet it with certain kind of non-conflict, not being troubled by it, not being troubled by what, you know, our inner life produces and does? And of course, what that means sometimes is that we are troubled. And the practice is, don't be troubled because you're troubled. Don't add more arrows, don't add on top of it. But somehow, when there are troubling things going on, how do we meet that? Can we meet it with non-conflict, an attention, awareness that just sees it for what it is? It allows it to be there in a certain wise way without getting entangled with it, without being for or against it. Just seeing, this is what's happening now. in the present moment, this is what's happening, and I'm going to sit here, stable on my seat, breathing, and be rooted here in this moment. I'm going to know that I'm present here in this moment. And in the present moment, there are these painful forces, painful reactions going on inside of me. But in this, the strength of being rooted and upright, there's perhaps a little distance or a little spaciousness or overview of the situation where we can hold it without, with some awareness that the awareness itself is not in conflict with what is. Just hold it. It's like this right now. Be with it. And I think that this is part of this purification through virtue, purification through finding a way to not cause harm to ourselves. And I think that it's quite profound not to add suffering to ourselves. You know, here, my motivation, my whole motivation to teach Buddhism, teach the practice, is really to help reduce the suffering in our world. And it's kind of unfortunate that sometimes that some of us suffer because of the teachings, because of Buddhism. Because we're trying to live up to certain ideals, we measure ourselves against how we think we're supposed to be. We have certain things we're kind of trying to attain and we're frustrated because we don't get concentrated fast enough. And we have a variety of attitudes about what should happen, about what's supposed to be, and that are innocent enough in and of themselves, but the way they're held, we end up hurting. It's frustrating, it's irritating, it's discouraging. So one of the important areas of practice, and I think why it's so useful to have it at the beginning of practice, is this kind of understanding what's going on with the whole world of harm making or harm generating and avoiding of harm. And it becomes more and more sophisticated and subtle how we understand it in ourselves, what goes on here. And the hope is that the deeper we understand this, the more we understand it, the more we're not troubled by what we see. We're not in conflict with what we see. It doesn't mean we condone it and allow whatever goes on for, you know, just goes on. But we're not adding more grief on top of it. And that learning how to be present without conflict, without being troubled, is a really important part of the training. It's a really important part of finding our way. It's the first horse. It's the stepping stone. It's the stage. Because that makes it so much easier for the next step, which is purification of mind, which is developing concentration, developing a mind that's not caught up by the hindrances. And the hindrances are very much motivated by, or fueled by, the discomforts we have, the sufferings we have, how we hurt in so many different ways. And so as the kind of sense of causing ourselves harm settles down, then, you know, there's the hindrance. It's easier to let the hindrances abate as well. One way of looking at this whole purification by virtue is that we're trying to also meet some of the basic human needs that we all have. And one of the primary human needs is a sense of safety. And, you know, a number of the developmental models of human growth or spiritual growth or, you know, like Maslow's hierarchy of needs begins with the most basic needs. And one of the basic needs is a sense of safety. And virtue, practice of virtue, is creating safety for our community, but also safety for ourselves. The world is a safer place, generally, to walk through if we're ethical. People are less angry with us, less upset with us. People tend to be kinder and more supportive of people who clearly are ethical and kind. As I've told the story maybe too many times of being in the kitchen at Tassajara, I was kind of the kitchen manager for the crew. And at one point, one of the people in my crew took me outside, and Gil, come outside, I need to talk to you. And he said to me, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out. So maybe sincerity is kind of like being ethical, so that helped. And I remember once, many years ago also, when I was quite young, this man came up to me quite angry because I had done something which I shouldn't have done. And he was going to fight. He was going to get into a good old-fashioned fight with me, his fists up and everything. And I wasn't thinking about what to do, but what I did was I dropped on one knee and opened my hands wide, my arms wide, and said, I can't fight. So you're pretty vulnerable that way, right? And he just spun around and walked away in disgust. Well, I didn't mind that too much. So I don't know if these two examples are examples of, you live an ethical life, dedicated to not harming, that, you're to some degree protected that way. And, but I think for meditation practitioners, what's more important is being protected from yourself. And in some ways, it can be the Dharma, in a sense, Dharma practice can be defined as a whole endeavor to learn how to be safe from yourself so that you don't cause harm to yourself. And I think in some ways, like the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about suffering and the cause of suffering, is the cause of suffering is something inside of ourselves, is our craving. So from that logic then, the craving we have that causes suffering is self-caused suffering in a certain way. So the practice is to learn to become safe for ourselves, create a safe environment in our heart, a safe environment in our mind, so that it's safe to be here. And we have a basic need for safety. And so some of the deeper and deeper work of Dharma practice, really helpful to have to be able to relax and settle in and open up and be vulnerable, to be open and receptive and ready for some change, dropping the ways which we have carry our armor or are closed. So some of I can underscore how valuable it is to have that sense of safety. And I would like to suggest the same thing I did last night, that there are conscious and subconscious areas of our hearts and minds. And I know that in the course of my years of practice, especially in the early years, that I was going through life relatively comfortable, and then I dropped into deeper layers of my mind that I kind of forgotten about. And I encountered places where I felt quite a lot of unresolved issues, a lot of fear that was left over from things that happened to me when I was younger. And I'd been carrying that with me, but I hadn't known how much I was carrying it with me. And so I got to face it and be with it. And so to begin creating a sense of a place where it's safe, a safe environment in our hearts, for whatever is there to feel it's okay to be there, to arise and show itself. When there's fear comes up, especially here on retreat, I think the great task is to help your fear feel safe. Rather than figuring out how quickly to get rid of the fear, or overcome the fear, or not have the fear, there your fear is, and how do you not be in conflict with your fear? How do you not be troubled by it? So the sense of fear, that fear that's bubbling up, feels like it's safe to be there, then something very different can happen. Perhaps you don't have to solve the fear, maybe you don't have to let go of anything, but maybe the fear begins to thaw and relax, like a young child who's afraid. The child's young enough, you don't go tell the child you're going to do psychoanalysis and help her, you know, solve her fear problems. You know, she's going to get probably feel worse and more afraid. But rather you hold the child, you create a safe environment, you kind of show that you're a safe person and allow her to be afraid in a safe place, and reassuring place, and with time she begins to relax and settle. So create a sense of safety for ourselves, safety for what goes on inside of ourselves, as part of this first purification. It's said that in developmental psychology that some of the other needs that people have is a sense of agency, sense that we can do something, that we have some power, some ability to act in the world. And I think that one of the great places to discover this is with this first purification, our virtue. That if we act in virtuous ways, we act in ethical ways, it's an act. It's a way of agency, that we can do something. And sometimes, I know, for example, living by the precepts, teachers give the teachings about the ethics and the precepts. Sometimes people do the same thing that I did when I heard these. Was, yeah, I know. You know, just like, I kind of, yeah, come on, let's get on with it now. This is like kindergarten Buddhism here. And, you know. And I kind of was not really paying that much attention to it. And, but to live ethically and to do it with confidence can give confidence to do it and really know this I can do, this powerful thing to live in the world and be someone who's safe for the world. I can offer that to the world. There aren't that, you know, maybe it's not enough people in the world who bring a sense of safety to others. The Buddha actually, one of the things the Buddha said was, make yourself safe for all beings. It's a great little instruction. Make yourself safe for all beings. So there's a sense of confidence and power and agency that can come from knowing that this is what we're dedicated to, an ethical life, a virtuous life. And I think it satisfies one of the basic human needs that we have, a feeling, a sense of purpose, a sense of agency, a sense of value. Sometimes people feel like they don't count and they're unimportant. Don't have much worth. And it's maybe not so useful to try to convince them that they're worthy. You know, they're just kind of maybe just moving ideas around, like moving deck chairs in the Titanic or something. But rather it's, but to help them understand how they can have some confidence, some sense of feeling that what they're doing is worthy and valuable by what they do, then it's something real and tangible. And one of the classic places to have this confidence and sense of agency and sense of personal power and personal sense of contribution to the world is to be ethical. And we come back to the retreat here. And in trying to find a way to live, to be here without conflict with things, without being troubled, with creating inner safety for yourself, this is a profound thing to do. Even if you don't succeed, the very effort to do so, to engage in it, to have some people in the world who are really dedicated to delve into themselves, to see what it takes to really be here in this moment in a free way, in a way that doesn't cause harm, in a way that's liberated without clinging. I mean, this is a gift that we give to the whole world, in the world where it's filled with clinging, filled with inner people living with inner conflict and outer conflict. So no, we don't not just through our actions we're exploring a new possible way of living, but we're exploring it in our hearts, in our minds. And I think it has tremendous, tremendous value. As valuable it is to be ethical, I think it's even more valuable to delve deep down inside and find the roots or the foundation of what makes us operate, so we can really purify that, develop that, rectify that, kind of help that become something which is a gift to ourselves in the world, that brings freedom. So as I said this morning, you know, one of the tasks in the retreat, especially the first day, is to try to get some clarity around, or momentum around, or developing a form of attention, form of awareness, where you can be aware of what's happening without being in conflict with it, what you're aware of, without being troubled with by anything. And that's not easy to do, but slowly, bit by bit, we learn to do it. And it's not uncommon for people on retreat to be troubled by something in the beginning of the retreat, but after 4 or 5 days, the same thing happens and we're not troubled by it. We can just, there it is, it arises and comes and goes. As Ajahn Chah said, I think he was referring to, there was lots of apparently noise in the monastery, and someone came and complained about all the noise that was bothering him, disturbing him. And Ajahn Chah said something like, it's not the sounds that are disturbing you, but you are disturbing the sounds. So, you know, so this idea that maybe some of you have had this experience of being bothered by something on a retreat, and after some days, you're no longer bothered. The classic one is someone who comes in with a Velcro jacket and they've come in late and they rip it off and then they put it back on again and then they snort a few times and then they decide to open their book and to write their diary with a scratchy pen, middle of the sitting or something. And so we're sitting there and, you know, indignant and upset, how could they? And the source of the problem is them. But they keep doing it, and after a while, it becomes easier and easier and less reactivity until it's just sound. Just sound, and has no meaning, it has no reaction, no disturbance, just comes, passes through. Or maybe even it's even helpful. I had this when I had this problem with someone on retreat. And after a while, one of the things that helped me kind of get more relaxed about it was the person would start making sounds, and I noticed after a while that when the person made sounds that I didn't like and was upset about, the sounds pulled me out of my fantasies. And so, I thought maybe it's a mindfulness bell, those sounds. And who am I to complain about those sounds when I wasn't practicing, I was lost in my thoughts. And so then I kind of took them as mindfulness bells, and there I am again, and lost in thought, and there I am again. And after a while, the sounds were no longer a problem for me. So in the beginning of the retreat, or all along the retreat, this training, what does it take to find, how can we just be with what is without the mind getting contracted or getting riled up or getting upset? How can we not disturb the sounds or disturb what's happening? How can we not be disturbed by it? I think it's a great training, a great thing to explore as a foundation, creating safety, having a sense of meaning and purpose in what we're doing here. Purpose of living a life that doesn't cause harm. And finally, what I want to say is that understanding that non-harm is kind of the principle of the Dharma, or the principle of for how we find a virtuous life living ethically, can also be very helpful in meditation practice, because if you're subtle enough, you can start noticing that you know, there's a certain kind of harm or stress that's put on if we're too greedy or too ambitious or trying too hard, straining to attain things, to get something. We do also cause a kind of harm when we're too complacent, when we're too accepting of everything, too tolerant. You know, if we just tolerate our suffering, then we're suffering. That's not exactly the practice either. So, you know, to find that middle way where we're engaged, present, rooted in the present moment, coming back, taking our seat, taking our stance, here I am, being here, and being here in a way that's as clear and embodied or connected as possible, but to do in a way that's neither stressful, neither tight nor slack, neither stressful nor, you know, lackadaisical, kind of whatever goes, goes, or something, but a certain kind of balanced effort and presence and engagement, sense of purpose, value, and importance in what we're doing. It's a fantastic thing that all of us are doing here, showing up, being present, exploring our life in this way. So may this stage of the practice, stage of purification through virtue, may it lead to a deep self-appreciation, a deep self-valuing and self-love, and so that self-valuing and positive self-regard is here to support you as we move on tomorrow onto the next horse. in our relay stations along the way. So thank you. And then I have one announcement. So I've posted on the door going into the dining room, on the right there, the list for times for practice discussion tomorrow. And I'll see half of you tomorrow and half of you the next day. And it... And the logic behind dividing you in two halves is alphabetical. And I try to take into account your work meditation and your bell ringing and that you might be doing. So if I didn't get it right, just let me know. And then everyone should probably double check the interview list tomorrow in case I moved you, make adjustments if I, you know, arrows that you to accommodate the different things that happens. But you should look at it tonight because I'll start doing some of them tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And and then I'll put tomorrow afternoon. I'll put up the list for the second day, for the other half of you. All right, thank you.